Coming up on Golf Today, Max Homa taking it to the max in D.C. with his fourth PGA Tour win, second this season, and an eye on a return to the site of his first win, Quail Hollow, for the President's Cup. And Rory gave it the old college try after making the cut on the number. We'll look back at his week and look ahead at his prospects for next week's PGA Championship. And an LPGA winner, European Solheim Cupper, Duke alum, Frenchwoman Celine Boutier hops on to talk about holding off two legends at the ShopRite last year and sharing a campus with a legend in Durham. It's all ahead right here. It's Golf Today.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
It is Golf Today on a Monday. Damon Hack alongside Eamon Lynch, Golf Week magazine. What's top of mind to you on May 9th, 2022, besides my horrible French accent?
Well, all eyes start to turn west now, Damon, right? Isn't it? We're into cowboy country.
Yeah.
The next few weeks out there, two Texas stops bookending the PGA Championship in Oklahoma. But obviously, before we get to Oklahoma, it's Max Homa's front of mind today.
Absolutely. Now a four-time winner on the PGA Tour. Let's take you back to some highlights from outside the nation's capital. Quite tough conditions over the weekend, but Max was up to the task. This is the ninth hole, the par three, 10-footer for birdie.
Made that, got to 8-under par and a share of the lead.
Yeah, really starting to join the fight with the 2011 PGA champion, Keegan Bradley. This is Max now, the 10th hole, the par five, trying to get up and down.
Posies is up to a few feet, made birdie, that got him to 9-under.
Yeah, beautiful shot there, very aggressive play. Now here's Keegan Bradley, the 11th hole, the par four from 471 yards. You can just see that lie, that does not look pretty.
And the result isn't particularly pretty either, Damon.
Yeah, leaning left usually means the ball goes right into the penalty area. He'd make double, drop back to 6-under. Now Max, 11th hole, par four. This par putt from 8 feet 7 inches.
This is a gut check moment right there. Remained at 9-under par, kept a 3-stroke lead.
Yeah, I made a bunch of those 9, 10-footers for birdie, for par as well. This is the 13th hole now, third from the green side bunker, tough shot.
Left that short, made a bogey, that dropped him back to 8-under.
Yeah, very difficult bunker shot. On to the 14th hole, this is the drivable par four. Say, when Keegan is right, he absolutely is one of the best tee to green.
This is not a part of the game he's typically struggled with over the last few years. Knocks this one to 48 feet.
Yeah, got a very kind bouncy 2-putt for birdie, get to 7-under now, just one shot back. But the 15th hole, Max Homa, second shot from 180 yards. Walking after it.
You would too, 13 feet. He'd make birdie, get back to 9-under, still 3 clear.
I might run after that one. Now the 16th hole, par four. Max's second from 159 yards.
This is more like one of your shots, Damon.
Yeah, you're right about that. Misses well right, make bogey, drop to 8-under. He's kind of rehearsing his swing a little bit, trying to, you know, find it, keep it going. So now here's Keegan trying to take advantage at 16.
From 8 feet. Got him to 7-under.
Yeah, so we've got a little bit of the fight left. Now the 18th hole after Keegan missed the fairway. This is Max tap in for the win. Second win of the season. Another hug for his caddy, Joe Greiner. Man from Cal, had so much promise coming out of college. Corn Ferry Tour, struggles with his game, trying to find his confidence. He has it now. He looked at multiple PGA Tour winners this season. Scotty Scheffler with 4. Max joined Sam Burns, Cam Smith, and Hideki Matsuyama with 2 each. So here's Max on where he has been and where he hopes to go.
Yeah, I care nothing. I care about nothing more than making that President's Cup team. So I'm really hoping Captain Davis Love III was watching today, or at least somebody messaged him about it. But that's all I've really cared about. I'm not a big goal setter, but Tour Championship and President's Cup, that's about all my focus has been ever since I missed that Ryder Cup last year and the Tour Championship. So this goes a long way.
Max, you've been so open about the battle with belief, self-belief, all that over the years. Where are you now after winning again? Is that going to be a continuing journey, or do you think you're finally settling to, I believe I should be out here?
It's a continuing journey. I know I should be out here, but every level you get to in this game, there's always something coming next. So like for Jon Rahm and Scottie Scheffler, the last couple world number ones, it's like you get there and now you have the entire world chasing you down. So it's like, what is, you still have, I'm sure, some minor insecurities about that or thoughts of it. So yeah, as I started to establish myself on this tour, when I won this event in 2019, I definitely knew I was capable of being a, you know, regular PGA Tour player. But then all of a sudden, you know, last year I get in the top 50 in the world. And then as you start looking around, it's a new crop of people. And then you start thinking to yourself, am I as good as these guys? And then, you know, I want to be top 10 in the world, play President's Cup, play Ryder Cups. Am I good enough to do that? So I've always struggled with it, but I have great people around me who bash me over the head, telling me that I am that guy. And I try to walk around this week believing that and faking it a little bit till I made it. And I will say, you know, I was with my coach Mark Blackburn last weekend in Alabama, and that was a big focus we had. And I will say that the faking it worked, because I showed up today and I felt very tall.
Your resume is always going to say you've won at least four PGA Tour events, but is it important that you got to the tour and went back and got to the tour and went back? Is that as important a part of the story?
For my story, yeah. I mean, it would be cool if I was Rory McIlroy and didn't do that. But, yeah, for me, it's something I carry with me that I think is such a – it's powerful. I feel like other guys don't have that, and that's good for them. I'm glad they don't. But I saw $18,000 in a year out here. I saw feeling very, very small, having literally no hope as to making getting a top 10, let alone – you know, making a cut that season. So I carry that because I've seen it. And you come out in the lead and I'm three strokes up, now I'm one stroke up. It just doesn't faze me as much as I feel like it could, because I know what bad is. And my bad today was going to be making boatload of money and moving along to the PGA Championship in 2 weeks with a good chance to win if I keep playing like this. So I think that's something I carry close to my chest, because I think it's something that, as much as nobody will want to have it, it's nice to have if you get through that tough time.
From feeling small to walking tall, Max Homa proving to be one of the best players in the game, especially since 2019. Players with four more PGA Tour wins, and Max Homa is on that list with a bunch of big-time names: Patrick Cantlay, Rory McIlroy, Colin Morikawa, and Justin Thomas, the only players with more wins than Max Homa since 2019. And not afraid, Eamon, to talk about his journey and feeling small and only making $18,000 in a year and wondering if he belonged. What did he prove to you this weekend?
Isn't it refreshing to hear a player who's got that wonderful mix of attitude and gratitude? And we've heard a lot, and we hear a lot these days from players who just want more. Whatever they have isn't enough, and we'll get to that, I guess, later in the show as well. But when you see a guy like Max Homa, who knows what rock bottom is on the PGA Tour, in that 2016-2017 season, he earned $18,008. He was 244th on the FedEx Cup point list out of 252 people who were ranked. And it didn't actually get better particularly quickly for Max Homa either, because even when he came back on tour a couple of years later, he had, for instance, the 2018-2019 season, he began with a tied 60th at the Safeway and then missed six cuts in a row. And it took him a few months later until he got that first win at Quail Hollow in the Wells Fargo Championship. And I just found it fascinating when he talks about this idea of needing a support system around him to tell him how good he is. And he said this publicly in the past, that he would keep telling himself, "I suck," after every bad shot, until finally his caddy and his coach and his wife started to beat him upside the head and say, "You don't suck. You're good enough to play and win on the PGA Tour." That attitude has brought a sea change, and the sea change is showing up in the results.
Yeah, you hear other players talk about tough times and struggles, and then you have Max Homa, who less than 4 years ago needed four straight birdies to finish his round out in the Korn Ferry Tour, or he'd have gone to Q School, someone who has gone back and forth between the big tours, someone who knows what rock bottom is and has come through it on the other side. And now he finds himself on these lists with Justin Thomas and Patrick Cantlay. He finds himself sixth in the President's Cup standings with six automatic picks. Obviously, there's more golf to be played. Do you think that he is finding himself to a point where he'll believe he is among the best players in the world and doesn't need to be knocked upside the head anymore, but knows that, you know what, I have a PGA championship next week. He's never made a top 10. In fact, he's missed 7 cuts in 10 major championship starts. Yeah. Do you think that now the worm will turn for him, that now it's just not just about belief in going through the tough times, but belief that he belongs with the John Rahms of the world?
Well, for a guy who doesn't think he belongs or didn't think he belongs, he's walking with some pretty rarefied company right now. In that list we just saw of guys with at least 4 tour wins since 2019, he's in there with the absolute elite of this game. And it's curious that with the 4 wins in the last 3 years, he's still only up to number 29 in the World Golf Rankings, which speaks a little to the inconsistency that he's shown in the past. That's less so an issue now. He only has 3 top 10s this season, and 2 of them are wins. And then he was tied 10th at the Genesis. But he's also got another 3 or 4 top 20 finishes in there. So he's starting to get more consistent on a week-to-week basis. But he really does seem like one of those guys for whom it's about attitude and setting goals. And I even thought it was interesting that he set that goal of the President's Cup, where he said in that press conference after the win yesterday that nothing means more than making that US team. And if you're Davis Love, that's exactly what you want to hear out of a guy who's perhaps going to be on the cusp. Right now, the top 6 qualify. He's 6th in the standings. But the commentary of a guy like Max Homa means something if you're Davis Love. If he's setting that as a goal, if that's what he's talking about, the day he's hoisted a trophy on the PGA Tour, he's talking about the team that you're captaining 4 months down the road. That's what you want to hear. And he also seems like one of those guys you could pair with a lot of people on your team.
He has great game, obviously, but how powerful is perspective? 31 years of age, expecting their first child, knows what rock bottom is in this game. It just seems like it's a very powerful 15th club. Doesn't seem to be kind of caught up with chasing the Joneses, as it were.
Yeah, when you back in that season when he made $18,008 back in 2016, 2017, he made 17 starts on the PGA Tour and he missed the cut 15 times.
Yeah.
That's a pretty hard way to win perspective. And what's interesting is that he hasn't lost any sight of that as the good times have come. And, you know, that old saying that you only appreciate the view from the highest mountains when you've been in the deepest valleys. Well, Max Homa has been in both of those places on the PGA Tour. It's nice to see somebody who has that perspective actually climb back on top these days.
And becoming a prolific winner now on the PGA Tour. We know he's prolific on social media, very popular on Twitter. Had to say this after his win. My soon-to-be-born son is going to have a hell of a job topping that Mother's Day. Good luck, kid. Thanks for the support, everyone. I appreciate you all. Hashtag golf. All right, folks, coming up, we've got the highlights from Rory's week at TPC Potomac. What are our takeaways? And what is Rory's takeaway as he prepares for the next mains major of the season? That's coming up next.
Golf Central Update, brought to you by Callaway Golf.
Rory making a move on the weekend. Fifth hole, par 4, 372 yards. This putt from 8 feet for birdie.
That got him to 3 under par, making a little move.
Yeah, wearing the pink sleeves for Mother's Day. Now the 8th hole, par 4, 12 feet for birdie. Nice to see the 4-time major champ rolling the rock.
That got him to 4 under. The noise growing a little bit louder.
It was. A little rowdy outside the nation's capital. This is the 10th hole, par 5, right to lefter.
5 under par, just 2 back of the lead.
Yeah, trying to give Max and Keegan something to think about. Now, 11th hole, the par 4. This long putt for birdie from 55 feet away.
And unfortunately, he didn't hit this one 55 feet. It was more like 45 feet.
Yeah, he would make bogey. He's saying, what's going on here? The wind in my face. Dropped back to 4 under at that point. Now, birdie putt. This is the drivable par 4, 14. This is a fun hole all week, I thought.
And a great up and down there and made it to get back to 5 under par.
Absolutely. And then trying to finish strong, the 18th hole par 4. This par putt from 8 feet away. Come on, finish strong. Putt goes wandering. He misses, posts that 4 under. Tell you what, it was a terrific weekend, though. Made the cut on the number. Back-to-back rounds of 68-68 for a solo fifth-place finish for Rory McIlroy. In tough conditions. The wind was up, rain, gnarly rough as well. And Rory spoke on his confidence level after Sunday's round.
Yeah, I'm playing good. Playing really good. No complaints with the game. Everything feels pretty solid. As I said, just a couple little things here and there coming down the stretch. A couple of missed putts. But really, apart from that, you know, I feel like the game's in good shape.
After being in the hunt back-to-back weeks now, going back to the Masters, is there anything you feel like you need to tidy up before you get to Tulsa? Are you comfortable with every aspect?
I'm really happy with where my game is. I think just another week of practicing and playing. And I can't really put my finger on any of my approach game's much better than it has been. I think, like, little things that aren't really, like shot selection, like, you know, the shot selection into 16 there, trying to hit a hard wedge and not quite getting all of it, hitting the slope, spinning back to the front of the green. You know, you hit a three-quarter nine iron, that maybe doesn't happen. So it's not even, it's not, you know, sometimes it's just like picking the right shot at the right time, stuff like that. But that's only stuff that you can learn from playing tournament golf, I guess.
How about the outright odds for the PGA Championship from our friends at PointsBet Sportsbook? Rory McIlroy making a move, not just in D.C., making a move on this board as well. Plus 1,400 trailing only John Rahm and the world number one, Scottie Scheffler. I mean, to hear Rory talk about, I got nothing really to work on except just getting ready for the PGA next week. No tweaks to his game. What does that tell you?
Tells you he's trending in the right direction. And it was interesting him noticing that his approach game is a lot better. Heading into this week, Rory was 95th in strokes gained approach on the PGA Tour. He was 12th in the field this week. Nobody actually hit more greens in regulation than Rory McIlroy this week at Wells Fargo. He led the field. And given the conditions and how difficult it was playing, a lot of guys hitting out of wet, rough, sloppy fairways out there, despite the best efforts of the crew down there at TPC Potomac, it was a pretty difficult condition. And for him to lead the field in greens and regulation, I think, is a pretty big deal for him, because he was 131st in greens and regulation percentage on tour heading into that tournament last week. So his numbers are going in the right direction. And we just saw him make a bunch of putts as well. He's in middle of the pack in putting on tour at the moment, 37th, but he was top 20 at Wells Fargo in that category as well. So if you're Rory and you're a guy who's looking at placing a bet for Southern Hills, he's a guy who seems to be drifting in the right direction.
Yeah, speaking of drifting, there's a lot of drifting leaves and, you know, flying all over the place. You get wind, you had rain. Hasn't always been the best poor weather player. It was brutal on Saturday. He made a fantastic move after making the cut on a number to shoot 68-68. Does that tell you something about him as well, that when the going got tough, I mean, Rory McIlroy was right there in the mix?
Yeah, that's always been the rap against Rory, yeah, that there's no fight in him.
Unfair?
That there's no grit. I think it's a little bit unfair. I mean, okay, people look back at some of the majors he won, obviously, were in foul weather conditions. Not necessarily that he was out there, yeah, in foul weather conditions, but it was pretty rough the last couple of days at Valhalla as well, when Rory hung in there in that kind of shootout with Phil Mickelson and Ricky Fowler back in 2014. But there's definitely, what we've seen is a little bit of grit when things aren't particularly going his way. And we saw that at Augusta National as well. It wasn't just the Sunday round that put Rory in there. There were tougher conditions earlier in the week and he didn't blow himself out of it. He didn't get impatient, which he's prone to do in the past, or overreach and get overly aggressive, trying to claw back too much, yeah, too soon. And what we saw over the weekend here, I thought, was pretty impressive, because, you know, you wouldn't send livestock out to work in the conditions that were out there. But those guys were out plodding away. And Rory McIlroy, he had a couple of opportunities where he could have just dropped his shoulders and taken himself out of it. Especially on Saturday, he got a couple over par early in his round and then fought his way back with four birdies in that one. So there was definitely a little more grit than he's probably given credit for there.
The putter was awake. The wedge game was much better than it has been. To me, the driver looked like a weapon again. To me, that remains, that's his sword, the Excalibur sword. The putter is the most important club in everybody's bag, but the driver is Rory McIlroy's weapon. And how much do you think that this great play that we saw from Rory was a carryover from the Masters? I truly believe that round, we will look back at the end of 2022 and say that was a turning point. The joy that he had, I think we saw it on the Sunday with the emotion at the Ryder Cup with the tears, but I think there was something about that final round at Augusta. He just seemed to be unburdened. He was enjoying it. He enjoyed being in the mix. He missed having the bit between the teeth. He missed having that energy. And I think that Masters Sunday is going to pay great dividends the rest of this season.
I tend to agree with you on that. There was a lot of pep in the step that Sunday at Augusta National. Even though he was going to come up short, and fair enough, it was never really that close because Scottie Scheffler was so dominant. But Rory McIlroy turned in the best round we've ever seen on a Sunday at Augusta National. You know, Gary Player did it 40-odd years ago when he won. But 64 in the final round of the Masters said a lot to him. But it's not so much in the grander scheme of this goal to try to win the career Grand Slam at Augusta National and knowing that he can compete there and do it, but what it does in the immediate short term. It's this elixir for a guy who's been searching for his swing now for probably the best part of a year and a half, and he's managed to win twice in the last year. It's not as though he's out there drifting around in the clouds. He has been a winner, and he's still ranked seventh in the official world golf ranking. But that round, to me, had everything going for him. He was hitting the ball really well.
Yeah.
He was putting really well. He wasn't searching during that round. And there were points this week where he was searching, but the grit kind of got him through those periods as well. And I think what we're seeing is a very positive hangover from Augusta National that I'm sure he hopes lasts another couple of weeks until he gets to Southern Hills.
Runner-up at the Masters, fifth-place finish at the Wells Fargo. You can call him a winner who didn't win, but how about some other winners who didn't win this past weekend at TPC Potomac, Avenel Farm? Do you have a player in mind who didn't take home the trophy but took something else home?
I got to go with Ricky Fowler on this
really?
One. And for a guy who's won five times on the PGA Tour, it seems odd to put so much stock in a tie for 21st, which is what Ricky did. But that's about it. He's only had one finish better than that in the last year since he played well at the PGA Championship. And in little areas, they showed incremental improvement. I mean, he was 181st in putting entering this tournament last week, Damon, and he was 10th in the field in the Wells Fargo Championship. And he was also had positive numbers, strokes gained tee to green for three of the 4 days. So there's still obviously work to be done there. He doesn't look as though he quite trusts what he's doing yet. But given how insecure Ricky's game has looked over the course of this season, we thought we were going to see some progress out of him with a tie for third back at the CJ Cup in Vegas last October. And it's kind of been crickets since then. He had a decent finish, top 20 at the Valspar, but this is his best finish outside of the Valspar in the last 7 months. So to me, that represents progress for a guy like Ricky.
It's going to be incremental steps, I still feel, for Ricky Fowler, and I think he is getting closer. Someone else who I think is knocking on the door is Cameron Young, who I think is going to lock up Rookie of the Year on the PGA Tour. He comes off now his third runner-up finish this season. He also finished tied for third at the RBC Heritage. He's a player who plays well in bunches. You'll recall in 2021 Korn Ferry Tour season, he actually won back-to-back starts. He seems to be on that kind of a run right now. I think he's going to break through for his first PGA Tour win very, very soon. Cameron Young, in my opinion, a winner who didn't win.
Is there really anyone else who's a contender for Rookie of the Year from Canada who just turned 25 on Saturday?
Yeah.
So he's celebrating. He's got the money for a nice party now after this latest one.
Yeah.
But is there anybody else that's in that realm of Rookie of the Year when you're finishing as high as consistently as Cameron Young is?
I don't think so. This is someone who's seeing a lot of these golf courses for maybe the first time, possibly the second time. And I just love the fact that he's putting himself in position to win, gaining experience, gaining in confidence, and someone who I said continues to play well in short spurts. I think that win is going to come very, very shortly for Cameron Young.
Well, speaking of winners, the LPGA Tour is making a couple of stops in New Jersey in the next few weeks. The Cognizant Founders Cup starts Thursday. Next month, the ShopRite LPGA Classic. The defending champion from there joins us after the break, Celine Boutier, coming up next. Here's a look at the upcoming LPGA Tour schedule, resuming this week after a 10-day break with the Cognizant Founders Cup at Upper Montclair in New Jersey. Then on to the Bank of Hope Match Play Championship out at Shadow Creek in Vegas, the US Women's Open at Pine Needles, and you see there at the bottom the ShopRite LPGA Classic at Seaview, New Jersey. And speaking of the ShopRite LPGA Classic, last year Celine Boutier started the final round 5 strokes off the lead, but birdied 2 of her last 3 holes to shoot an 8 under par 63 and win the event for her second LPGA Tour career win. And here's a look at Celine Boutier's 22 season, has made the cut in all 9 starts, 5 top 10 finishes, tied for 4th in the Chevron Championship, and her best finish was 3rd at the Honda LPGA Thailand Championship. We're pleased now to be joined with Celine Boutier. Celine, thanks for joining us. I want to go back to last year's victory. You shot 63, then waited in the clubhouse while the number 2 player in the world and the number 3 player in the world, Jin Young Ko and NB Park, both had a putt to beat you, or sorry, tie you, on the last hole. What were those nerves like for you back then?
It was actually, I was more nervous just waiting for them to finish than actually playing and being out there on the course. It was kind of a surreal experience. And actually, honestly, I was expecting to go in the playoff because, like you said, Jin Young and Inbi, I mean, they need no introduction and they had been playing so solid. And so I was kind of getting myself ready to, you know, go out there and be in the playoff. And then with Mr. Putz, I kind of, it took me a little while to actually realize that I had just won the tournament. But no, I mean, yeah, it was just a great final round. And I'm just, honestly, I was just so nervous going to the playoff. I was kind of happy not having to do that. So it was a great way also to finish the tournament.
So you're at media day at the shop, right? You got media members playing some golf. Like, give us a sense of what you're going to be doing today.
Yeah, I just went out there on the course just to meet a few of the media persons and everyone that's involved with the tournament. And I'll tell you what, it's not playing easy right now. It's blowing about 35 miles an hour. And I was really happy not to be playing the full 18 round because it's playing definitely very tough and very cold. But it's been fun so far, and I'm just going to meet some more people and just thank everyone that's supporting the tournament this year and the past few years.
Celine, you seem to be making a steady rise in the game from the Epson Tour, winner on the LET, LPGA, Solheim Cupper. At what point did you feel like you really belonged out there?
I think it's been a process for sure. But I would say maybe my third year, I feel like I had a really solid solid season. And then I just feel like I always prove myself in a way. So I don't normally feel like there's, you know, a certain tournament or a point where I felt like I definitely belonged. But it's definitely been a process. I just feel like I've been getting better and better every year. And I just hope to keep going for the next few years.
Speaking of getting better, there's one category in which you're the best on the LPGA Tour, Celine. No one out there has actually made more birdies than you this year. You're number one on tour in that. Does that make you feel as though you're closer to win number three?
I sure hope so. I mean, I wasn't aware of that stats, but I feel like I've definitely been closer this year than any year in winning tournaments. A lot more into position, it's in contention in the last few rounds. So I feel like, you know, that's the goal. I just want to put myself out there the more often, and then the more chance I will have to win. So I hope I'm definitely, you know, going to do that soon. But I am very satisfied with the way my game is headed right now. And I just, like I said, just want to put myself out there the more often.
Celine, the number of French professional golfers seems small by comparison to other countries. How did you end up in this crazy game?
It is definitely not the most popular sport in France, for sure. But it's definitely growing, for sure. I think we have a few more rookies this year. So it's definitely very, very encouraging. I personally started with my dad, who's a really big golf player, like golf fan in general, and just took us, me and my siblings, out on the course one day. So that's how I got hooked.
You're coming off a tie for fourth at the Chevron Championship, Celine, which is your best finish in a major championship. Is that what you look to as the next level for you to move up in the LPGA game?
Oh, for sure. I'm definitely focusing a little bit more on majors this year. I feel like, you know, it's just the best test in golf, just to be able to play the most difficult courses and under the best, the most pressure. And I feel like if you can succeed in those conditions, you can pretty much succeed anywhere. So I've definitely have some big goals for majors this year. And finishing fourth at the Chevron this year is very encouraging. And I was also super happy to be able to finish that high the last year in Mission Hills. So that was definitely a big highlight for me. But yeah, hopefully I can keep going for the next few majors coming up.
Celine, you're a Duke alum. Duke's longtime basketball coach, Coach K, of course, stepped down this year. How much time did you spend going to basketball games at Camden? You know, did you put on the blue face paint? Were you sleeping out, you know, outside before the game, making sure you got a good seat?
Yeah, I definitely went as much as I could, but I never... Or like our coaches didn't really want us to tent outside and go too crazy just because it could get pretty cold, especially, you know, with the wait times that we had to be there outside. It was kind of a little bit risky for us. But I enjoyed my time going to games for sure. It was probably the light of my Duke time, just going to games because they're so fun. So I definitely keep them in check and try to follow and support my Blue Devils as much as I can.
Yeah, sleeping in a tent and a sleeping bag outside when it's cold, probably not great for the golf swing. Celine, enjoy media day out at Seaview, and best of luck in your title defense in June. We'll speak to you soon.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, Celine Boutier with the LPGA Tour. Let's take a look at who's in the race to the CME Globe at this point in the season. A little bit early, you know, still lots of big-time tournaments. Danielle King, what a start she has had at 2022. Nana Kurtz, Mads, and Jin Young Ko is finding her feet once again. And good to see Lydia Ko. And there's Celine Boutier holding strong at number six in the race to the CME Globe. Sticking with the LPGA, in the fall of 2002, Annika Sorenstam was the best golfer on the LPGA Tour. By the summer of 2003, she was one of the most popular athletes in the world. Here's a sneak peek from Becoming Annika, the one-hour documentary narrated by Hilary Swank that chronicles the remarkable career of one of the game's most iconic figures.
I think visitors remember three things from Rubalsta when playing here. Number one, that it's a very beautiful area. Number two, that the greens are not flat all the time. And number three, these greens have fostered Annika.
Annika Sorenstam and her younger sister, Charlotta, began playing golf as kids when their parents took up the game as a hobby. The family purchased one set of clubs for the girls, figuring they could share the set.
One of the girls got the odd number club, and the other got the even number club.
We didn't buy any balls for them. They picked them in the four dresses.
My first memories, in fact, were from the driving range. She and Charlotta were standing on that little piece of ground, you know, with the two umbrellas, and playing back and forth to each other. And I looked at them when I came down in the morning to guide the machines. I said, gee, what are they doing? And when I went home in the evening, they were still there, hitting balls back and forth. It seems that practice pays off.
To her family, Annika was warm, if a bit competitive, but outwardly, she was painfully shy and deeply uncomfortable in front of others, which became a problem as her golf game continued to improve.
I was just terrified. I mean, I didn't raise up my hand in class to answer a question because I thought, you know, if I say the wrong thing, you know, my classmates would laugh at me. The same thing in golf.
Well, if she was in the lead, she was scared of the possibility of making a winner speech. I think she saw more of that as a problem than actually winning the tournament.
I didn't want to go on that little podium, and I didn't want everybody to look at me. So, you know, I would miss on purpose. Maybe just leave the ball in the bunker. I know that I would finish second or third. You can imagine sitting in the car going home. It's like, why did I do that? Why am I ruining it for myself?
It must have been quite painful for her to have even thought about that, because she's the most competitive person I know.
Some told the tournament director for juniors that even the second player should have been have a speech. So then Annika stopped the missing putts.
Becoming Annika debuts Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern right here on Golf Channel. Golf Today is back after this.
It's almost time for the talking to stop and the action to start when it comes to Saudi-financed golf tournaments. Deadlines are looming for players to raise their hands and for the PGA Tour to respond. We lay it all out. Shane Ryan is going to join us. He's the author of The Cup They Couldn't Lose, a new book that takes us behind the scenes at the 2021 Ryder Cup. And with a nod to Rich Strike at Churchill Downs, we look back at the greatest long shots in golf history. Golf Today continues now.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Welcome back into Hour 2 of Golf Today. I'm Eamon Lynch alongside Damon Hack, and Damon, there's really two themes we're talking about right now. It's Max Homa, Oklahoma. Sounds as though those two things go pretty well together.
I could see the Tulsa World editors coming up with a headline right now. You know, Homa wins a major in Oklahoma. He seems to be in that perfect place right now where he cares about his game. He doesn't care that much about it. It's that kind of sweet spot of athletic excellence where you are just kind of seeing the ball well. Everything's moving slowly. I loved his gait this past week, the way he walked, the way he carried himself. Just nothing seemed to be that big of a deal. That's a really fun place to be in sports.
It really is, and it's, as we said earlier in the show, attitude and gratitude is a really nice mix to have because we don't see that every week out here.
Got a lot of perspective. 31-year-old Cal Golden Bear. Let's flash back, by the way, 3 years ago, Max Homa's first win on the PGA Tour coming at the 2019 Wells Fargo, played at its usual host site, Quail Hollow. How about that reaction? It's been a long road from winning the 2013 men's NCAA individual title for Cal to his first win on tour. But since then, he's grown into a closer come Sundays. And time now for Winning Moments presented by Wynn Grips. Max Homa finishes two shots ahead of Matt Fitzpatrick, Cameron Young, and Keegan Bradley to win the Wells Fargo Championship for the second time, joining three-time winner Rory McIlroy as multiple winners of the event. Homa becomes the fifth multiple winner of this season, braving all those elements outside of D.C. as well. Take a look at the leaderboard. You see there that notable, that's Sergio Garcia's name on the leaderboard, finished the tournament in a tie for 21st at even par. But in case you missed it, his opening round didn't come without a bit of drama. Following an errant tee shot on 10, he was assessed a penalty after not being able to find his ball in the 3 minute allotted time. In a moment of frustration, Sergio blurted out his possible plans for the future, and it doesn't sound like it includes the PGA Tour. See what you make of Sergio's latest outburst.
When you got into here and started searching,
I mean, but I can't. You want to swim through the river? I mean, I wasn't looking for the ball there. I was looking for the ball once I got over this side. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, I knew it was on this side of the river.
Okay. I mean, I started the clock when you got over into here. So, I mean, if you said you weren't searching for it, you were trying to get to the other side, then that's different.
So you said it took too long. Can't wait to leave this group. Can't wait to get out of here, my friend. A couple more weeks, I don't have to deal with you anymore.
That's your 2017 Masters champ. I tell you, I guess the ruling was erroneous. Mm-hmm. Kate, we learned a day later. I've covered Sergio for a long time. I enjoy talking to him. I love watching him play. But this petulance, it just always seems to be bubbling right underneath the surface and sometimes overt and in our face, whether it's that or the expectorating into a cup or destroying the bunker in the Middle East. I kept thinking that the green jacket was going to kind of take all that away and he would kind of grow into this elder statesman.
It's very much on brand, I suppose. And that rules official must really have felt like the bartender who denies a belligerent drunk service, only to be told the drunk's going to take his custom elsewhere. I mean, the palpable sense of relief that must have passed through tour officials with the thought that Sergio might actually leave the tour. This may actually be the only reason to root for the Saudi ambitions in golf, is the possibility that they might take Sergio away, because this is very much on brand. He's not an entirely one-dimensional person. He can be amiable, he can be funny, he can be charming in his own way. Terrific player, great record, but a weapons-grade whiner, and always has been for his entire career. And it's not just, you know, the flinging of a shoe 20 years ago into the gallery because his foot slipped, spitting into a cup. He's had a racially charged comment that he made about Tiger Woods. He was thrown out of a tournament in Saudi Arabia because he tomahawked his club into five greens and defaced those greens. Think about that for a moment. He is too beyond the pale for the Saudi international, where his conduct had to get him kicked out of there. It's very much on brand for Sergio. And this is what entitlement looks like in professional golf. When you see the guy who won this tournament, and then you see the guy who didn't even face the media for 2 days after he made those comments, one of them represents the future of the game. One of them pretty much represents the past.
He's 42 years of age. You wrote a column about Sergio Garcia for Golf Week magazine. At what point did the idea spring to life? Was it simply that moment there with the rules official? Were you thinking about it beforehand, or was that kind of the tipping point, seeing Sergio's behavior and then his comments about, I can't wait to leave this tour. I can't wait to be out of here.
Well, like most people, I haven't really had cause to think about Sergio for a very long time. He's played 18 major championships since he won the Masters in 2017. He's missed 11 cuts. He's only had two top 20 finishes in that time, and both of them were ties for 19th, Damon. And you're seeing this from a lot of players now. You saw bizarre remarks that Lee Westwood made last week in London as well about the potential for the LIV Golf events, the Saudi events, and his own future with those events. And so you'll see more and more names percolate up, and they all seem to have certain characteristics in common. Their best days are largely in the rearview mirror. For the most part, they seem to have accomplished in major championships what they're likely to accomplish. They don't play well enough to benefit from increased purses on either the PGA Tour or the DP World Tour. They're not well-liked enough to get the fan engagement bonuses like the Player Impact Program, and they're all extraordinarily entitled. Mm. And Sergio is perhaps the greatest example of that. He's made $54 million on the PGA Tour and yet stands there and berates a rules official telling him he can't wait to leave. Well, there are probably a lot of fans who won't cry if that day comes when Sergio does leave.
Any redemption for Sergio possible at this point, at 42? Do we already know who he is? It used to be, well, he's young, he's El Nino, he's from Spain, he has passion. We used to hear all of these things, and now here he is, you know, 42 years of age. You kind of are who you are at the age of 42, at least in my experience.
Yeah, but doesn't it seem so odd from that kid who scissor-kicked his way up the fairway at Medina in 1999? There was a kind of a joyful effervescence about Sergio Garcia back then. But somewhere pretty shortly after that, it all seemed to kind of ebb away, the frustrations, the constantly being asked about major championships, the coming up short in major championships. But there's always been one theme throughout that. If you remember when he lost the Open Championship to Padraig Harrington at Carnoustie in 2007... he made a bogey on the last hole, and in his comments afterwards, he blamed the bunker rakers in the group ahead who had taken too much time and unseen forces.
Yeah, the ghosts. I was there for the New York Times. I'll never forget it. It was the oddest. It was so bizarre. I mean, later it kind of became on brand, as you said, but it was like, wait a second. He blames, you know, when Tiger at Bethpage in 02, the rain, and, you know, when he was out in the rain. If Tiger had been out there, they would have stopped it. In 07, he's blaming these unseen forces, these ghosts. Yeah, I was there at Carnoustie. I remember that moment.
It's never Sergio's fault. And no matter what tour Sergio ends up playing on, whether he remains a dual member of the DP World Tour and PGA Tours, or if he decides to pull up stakes and move to these LIV Golf Invitational events, one thing is not going to change. Sergio is still going to be Sergio. Mm. The question is, who's going to have to wipe his nose for him?
Yeah, well, you mentioned LIV Golf. There are a lot of important dates, these kind of mileposts coming up this spring and summer. Starting tomorrow, the deadline for response to conflicting event releases for the first LIV event, and that May 17th deadline for players to apply for releases for the second event into the summer, June. I mean, and look, there are major championships going on as all these LIV events and deadlines, the LIV event at the Centurion Club in England, then the U.S. Open at the Country Club the next week, the second LIV event in the United States at Pumpkin Ridge. That's a very important distinction. And then, of course, the Open Championship, the 150th at the Old Course at St. Andrews. When we look at these dates upcoming, beginning with tomorrow, what should the folks at home know? Why is tomorrow so significant?
Tomorrow is significant only in the sense that it's the deadline by which the PGA Tour has to grant or deny waivers for players who want to go play in London, which every PGA Tour member is required to get a release to play an event organised by a rival tour. It's the membership rules they've all signed up to. They've always existed this way. But tomorrow's, in a way, a distraction. The London event is a distraction because precedent exists for players to go on an overseas money grab.
Sure.
And this is no different than going to play the Saudi International. My expectation is that by tomorrow the tour will announce that they have granted X number of waivers, however many players have requested them. And they may attach some conditions to that, as they did with the Saudi International event, which was going up against the AT&T at Pebble Beach. And the tour required people who went to Saudi Arabia to commit to playing at Pebble Beach a certain number of times in the years to come. That's not really a significant occurrence to me. Next week, it's more significant. May 17th, Tuesday of the PGA Championship, is the deadline by which players are required to ask for a release to go play in Portland. the second Saudi event.
So Pumpkin let me interrupt Ridge. You there. There could be a situation where we're in Tulsa next week. Mm-hmm. The release for the second event will have to be in put in play at that point. There could be reporters asking players on the ground in mm-hmm. Tulsa, did you apply for a release to the second live event, which is in Portland, Oregon. Am I correct in that?
Correct. That Tuesday is the deadline, and none of these guys seem all that eager to acknowledge in public whether or not they're going to apply for that. The deadline by which the tour has to respond is June 1st.
Right.
The reality is the tour could respond at 5:01 p.m. next Tuesday because it's a no. A yes is not possible. PGA Tour protocols, which all of these guys have signed up for, suggest that no waiver can be given for an event being held against their own schedule in North America.
So why would a player even apply? Maybe a player would just say, you know what, I'm just going to show up. I'll show up in Portland. And that's where the rubber meets the road. If the regulations of the tour don't allow players to compete on a rival tour in the United States, where's this headed?
Well, it's headed, it seems, inexorably towards disciplinary action, potential litigation. At some point, you may see players who will apply for the release to at least signal their desire to play in this event. If the tour denies that release, then they have the option of defying that ruling and risking disciplinary proceedings, which would then potentially trigger litigation. But it may be a little optimistic to think that everyone who intends to play that event in Portland will go through the proper protocol of asking for a release. It's very possible, knowing that the denial is going to be set in stone, that there is not an option of a yes. I think you may very well see a player who won't even bother applying for the protocol, and we won't know that until that player then shows up to play in Portland July 1st through 3rd.
How potentially messy could this spring and summer be? You wrote a fantastic column for Golf Week about how, just because of the way the schedule falls this year, that so many of these deadlines come at the time where major championships are being celebrated or looked ahead to. How much could this potentially hang over next week in Tulsa, or perhaps at the Country Club, or perhaps at the Old Course?
I don't think any major championship is going to be unscathed here, Damon, because we're going to see, obviously, this deadline that comes up next week during the PGA Championship. The first Saudi event in London is played the weekend before the US Open begins. And if there is a disciplinary proceeding that somehow is triggered by players deciding to go to Portland without a permission to play, well, then that event concludes a week before the Open Championship begins at St. Andrews. So it's very, very possible that the RNA could face the scenario of players who may be eligible for the Open Championship who are not in good standing with the PGA Tour. It depends how quickly the tour would choose to act against players if some players choose to defy that ban.
Do you feel like the voices of Jon Rahm and Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas have put the PGA Tour in a position of strength, regardless of what Phil Mickelson, Lee Westwood, Sergio Garcia do?
It's more that it's put the LIV Golf Investments and Greg Norman in a position of weakness, because you look at the players that they have and look at the players who have chosen not to align themselves
right
with this. You know, Tiger's out, JT's out, Spieth is out, Rory is out, Brooks is out, Rahm is out, DJ is out. And who do they have? They have Lee Westwood, they have Sergio Garcia. Robert Garrigues wanted a spot in the field if he could get it. Potentially Martin Keimer joining. They don't have people who are relevant to them. And to me, that's their biggest problem as a product, is that they do not have anyone really that fans particularly care about. Mm.
The intrigue continues. Spring and summer, always a busy time in professional golf. This spring and summer, maybe busier than we could have even expected.
It really could. And uncertainties and bitter rivalries and grievances aren't just a Saudi thing. For years, they've been the dynamics in the Ryder Cup team room too. When we come back, we'll have Shane Ryan, who's just written a book detailing how Team USA got its act together at Whistling Straits.
And we're back on Golf Today. Last September, the U.S. Ryder Cup team put on one of the greatest displays of all time, defeating the Europeans 19-9 at Whistling Straits in Kohler, Wisconsin. With more on this incredible showdown, be sure to check out Shane Ryan's book, which comes out this Tuesday, The Cup They Couldn't Lose, America, the Ryder Cup, and the Long Road to Whistling Straits. And the author, Shane Ryan, joins us on this Monday. Great to see you, pal. This book seemed to come out after some pretty tough American losses before Whistling Straits. How did this project come together for you?
Yeah, you know, I could probably say it goes all the way back to childhood. The Ryder Cup has always had a really special place in my heart. Maybe it was the bagpipes and the theme music, but it's always held a certain romance. And it just so happened, you know, in my unusual road to writing about golf, the very first tournament I covered was the Ryder Cup in Medina in 2012 and that incredible European comeback, which, you know, sort of cemented it in my mind as this wonderful event. And so I kind of decided then that, you know, if the opportunity came up, I would eventually like to write a Ryder Cup book. And really, that's what happened. And so, you know, like you said, the focus of this book is Whistling Straits. But it's also about, you know, how Europe came to dominate and control the Ryder Cup. And then how, after 30 long years, America finally figured out how to come back and reverse that.
Shane, Steve Stricker was the first American captain in the history of the Ryder Cup who'd never won a major championship. And there were all of these rumours almost beforehand that he's too nice to be the Ryder Cup captain. That didn't turn out to be the reality, though. He made some pretty tough decisions along the way, right?
That's right. Yeah, it reminded me a little bit of when 2014, when people said that Paul McGinley just didn't have the stature in the game to stand up to a guy like Tom Watson. And we saw how that went. You know, major championships are really not that important when it comes to captaining a Ryder Cup. You know, Steve Stricker did a wonderful job, not just managing the team, but, you know, certain things that you would think, oh, you need a stern personality, like to stop the DeChambeau-Koepka feud or to make that a non-issue. You know, he handled that with incredible deftness and grace. And, you know, he proved up to the task really at every single juncture on the way to winning this Ryder Cup.
Shane, you spent some time on Patrick Reed and his journey from villain to Captain America and back to villain, it seems. Where does he fit into the U.S. team picture right now?
Well, you know, Steve Stricker was an assistant captain at Melbourne. And, you know, everything that happened in the Bahamas with Patrick Reed happened right before Melbourne. And so the U.S. had to answer questions about him. It was kind of a distraction. Then his caddy gets kicked out, you know, for fighting a fan at Melbourne. So, you know, Steve Stricker saw all that. He ended up having a really good excuse not to take him on the team when the time came, because Patrick Reed obviously had been hospitalized. But I texted him at one point saying, you know, would you have taken Patrick if he was healthy, if he was where he was? And the response I got was, I'll choose not to answer that question, with a little winking emoji. But I would say, to put it diplomatically, if I were Patrick Reed, I would want to be qualifying for these teams by the points and not relying on a captain's pick.
Shane, speaking of people who didn't actually make the team, Stricker was announced as captain in February of 2019. Then the pandemic hits, and it's 2.5 years before he actually gets to captain. And in that time, both Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson won major championships, and neither one of them made the team. That would have seemed very improbable at the time.
Yeah, definitely. You know, with Tiger, you know, we saw what happened with him. But I think Phil Mickelson is really the more interesting one when you go, not only did he win a major championship, but pretty, you know, the year of the Ryder Cup, pretty close to when this all happened. And that's another case where I think Stricker showed a real strong sense of diplomacy in, I don't know if I want to use the word sidelining, but really taking the enormous personality that is Phil Mickelson, not just saying you're not going to be on the Ryder Cup team when you won a major, but turning him into a vice captain and making him sort of a, you know, a positive force for Team USA. Again, he kind of nailed it there.
Shane, how volatile was the Brooks-Bryson dust-up in your reporting and Kohler and its potential to really wreck things for the U.S. team?
You know, it reached, I think, its peak of volatility that summer. And I don't mean between Koepka and DeChambeau. I more mean how the fans were treating DeChambeau. And I know, you look, I realize he's not a sympathetic figure, and I'm not here to try to convince people to think Bryson DeChambeau is the greatest guy in golf. However, it was pretty intense, and Koepka wasn't backing down. Koepka wasn't saying to people, hey, give this guy a break. And so, you know, we've seen in past Ryder Cups where, or President's Cups even, where these dramatic things kind of, you know, torpedo the U.S. And Stricker really, I think he brought these guys together early, made the point that this cannot be an issue. This can't be the thing that, you know, leads to us losing. And, you know, choreographed a few things, like on the range, they gave each other a hug. And as we see here, they gave each other a hug in the press conference, just completely diffused it. And they had dinner together, and, you know, they're not the greatest of friends. Nobody's going to say that, but it did work what he did.
Shane, one of the interesting parts of the book I found was where the U.S. team has clearly stolen some old, European ideas. And one of the examples you gave was Stricker had his team meetings every night in the clubhouse before guys went back to the hotel, whereas the Europeans got their police escort back to the American club and then had their meetings, had to regroup. In what other ways did you see Stricker have the kind of savvy that had become associated with the other side of this Ryder Cup over the years?
You know, yeah, there's a lot of different things. I mean, he picked up some things that were American in origin, like, you know, Paul Azinger's pod system, this idea that we're not going to try to have 12 people unite. That's too many. These guys are essentially selfish operators. That's how they live their lives. So we're going to keep them in smaller groups. In terms of things he learned from the Europeans, you know, he learned that we're going to try to manipulate this course to our advantage as best we can. We are going to study the lineups really, really hard and figure out which guys work well together. And then there are other things like just adopting the use of these advanced statistics to show, again, not just what partnerships are going to work, but, you know, which guys are going to play well together, you know, where you should put your guys in singles, really taking every single element they have learned over the course of, let's call it 40 years since the Ryder Cup really started being competitive, and sticking to this process of institutional memory, where you don't just learn from your failures and your mistakes, but you learn from your successes as well.
So, Shane, since this was the cup they couldn't lose, and they didn't, should the American golf fan at home feel like Italy will be the continuation of good vibes, or are there still some danger signs?
You know, the ultimate danger sign, I guess, is history, because the U.S. has not won in Europe since 1993. It's going to be more than 30 years by the time we get to Europe. And so that shows you how tough it is. That being said, you know, just one quick story, talking to Davis Love after this Ryder Cup, you know, he said to me, you know, there's a lot of things, there's so much that we have to do better. And I said, how can that be? You know, you just won 19-9. It was the biggest blowout ever. And he said, well, you know, we're thinking about the food they eat and the transportation. And that kind of clicked for me that there is absolutely nothing from the big stuff to the small stuff that these guys aren't considering. I think starting with the task force after being humiliated at Glen Eagles, they really, you know, took on the mission of learning about the Ryder Cup, learning what the Europeans had done, trying their best to do everything possible to win. And I think USA is rising in their fortunes, including having really good young players at a time when Europe might be declining. So sure, I'll go on record now. I think they're going to win in Italy for the first time in three decades. And I do think we're in an era where the U.S. is going to start to be really, really dominant in this event.
Wow. A lot of juicy tidbits, by the way, in this book. Highly recommended. Shane, thanks so much for your time and hopping on. I'm enjoying the book and hopefully the folks at home will as well. And we'll speak to you soon.
I really appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
And there it is. Be sure to check it out. Shane Ryan's book comes out Tuesday. The Cup They Couldn't Lose, America, the Ryder Cup, and the Long Road to Whistling Straits. And on Saturday, the world witnessed a run for the roses and a win for the ages as Rich Strike defied the odds to win the Kentucky Derby. Improbable victory got us thinking about some of golf's great underdogs. We discuss after the break. Eamon, it's been a while, but it's time. We're bringing back our best bets of the week. TPC Potomac is the site, Wells Fargo Championship. Do you have a best bet for the people? They're looking for some insight.
The one I've really got my eye on is perhaps the most intriguing threesome out there in the first round. It's Rory McIlroy, Webb Simpson, Francesco Molinari. All of them have different forms of good history for this tournament. In Rory McIlroy's case, obviously, he's won the Wells Fargo four times. Three times. Webb Simpson has also got a great record when it's played in Charlotte. And Francesco Molinari, he was the winner the last time the PGA Tour was here at TPC Potomac back in 2018 in the Quicken Loans National Tournament. So to me, that's the intriguing group, and I'm going to put a little bet on Rory McIlroy to shoot the low score among the three. May not be the lowest score by the time we get to the weekend,
right,
but I'm betting on him to shoot the low score tomorrow.
I think Rory's going to win this week, so I like the way you're thinking. I'm thinking a top 20 for Gary Woodland. That's my best bet. He has three top eight finishes in his last seven starts. Good history at TPC golf courses in general. Played very well, of course, winner in Phoenix a few years back. He played very well at San Antonio. Had a recent top 10 at that TPC course. He's a major champ. He played in the field in 2018 when it was the Quicken Loans. So I'm thinking Gary Woodland, top 20, plus 160. So it's not like a crazy amount of stress.
Yeah, I was just running my mouth saying a whole bunch of nothing. Gary Woodland missed the cut. I feel horrible. I was way off. No top 20 for G-Dub.
I feel worse because I didn't actually place the bet that I said I wanted to.
And you got it right.
And it would have been a pretty lucrative little bet there.
That was well done. Rory did play better than Francesco and Webb Simpson for the entire week. So you got the first round right. I said Rory's going to win. I mean, he finished fifth.
He looked pretty good on Thursday, though. He shot 67 Thursday, which, you know, against Jason Day's opening scores for a couple of days there, it didn't look as impressive, but it was certainly the best one out of his threesome. And it held up pretty well over the weekend.
Well, I was showing you how the whole thing works before the show, and then you end up, you're one for one, buddy. Congratulations.
That's the only streak I'm currently riding in all of golf, Damon.
All right, buddy. Speaking of bets, there are plenty of bets made on Saturday. Churchill Downs and those who put their money on an 80-1 underdog, Rich Strike, are celebrating today. Stunning victory on Saturday. The horse had the second longest odds ever of a Kentucky Derby winner. Rich Strike wasn't even in the field until Friday, thanks to a late scratch from Ethereal Road. That picture, the run for the roses. Beautiful animal. Justin Thomas, of course, a native of Kentucky. So you're saying there's a chance, the 80-1, yes, indeed, that 80-1 came in. Hashtag Kentucky Derby, little dumb and dumber loves. That got us to thinking a little bit about golf's great underdogs. Everybody loves an underdog story, I think, not just in golf, but in sports. But let's stick to golf, an underdog story that you think kind of tops them all.
Certainly in recent memory, to me, it's got to be John Daly at Crooked Stick 31 years ago, back at the 1991 PGA Championship. He got in as the ninth alternate. When Nick Price withdrew, he drove through the night from Arkansas to get there to Indiana. He took the lead on Friday, which is, to me, the remarkable part, is that as a complete no-name, he took the lead Friday and he never lost it. Again, went on to beat Brooks Liske by three strokes on Sunday evening. And to me, that was just a right-out-of-nowhere fairy tale. I mean, it got a lot more complicated in the years after that, but that was an underdog.
I think it's fair because some people say, oh, the talent that he had, he could have done this, he could have done that. He won two major championships, only five total PGA Tour events at all. But considering how he grew up and considering some of the vices that he's had, some might say he's overachieved in a certain sense. Are you going there or you're not going to go there?
I'm not going there. He's overachieved in terms of his ability to manage or to find a governor switch on his own behavior over the years. But to me, it's one of the most remarkable statistics in golf that John Daly has two majors, and per our last segment discussing it with Shane Ryan, he won both of them in Ryder Cup years, never played
about
the Ryder
that?
Cup though, wasn't chosen, but he only has one other top 10 finish in his entire career in major championships. It was a tied third at the Masters in 1993, and when you look at the year since, you know, he's at 38 missed cuts in majors, four WDs. It's been a pretty ignominious record in majors since then. But that was a real fairy tale in 1991. But you know, is Daly yours? Who do you have that can top a John Daly fairy tale?
How about Sofia Popov?
That's a pretty good one.
Winning the Women's Open a couple of years ago. She had won 4 months earlier, not on the LPGA or the Epson Tour, the Cactus Tour 4 months before. Her and her mom were clinking champagne glasses, according to a great article from our buddy Beth Ann Nichols. She had the top 10 in the marathon just to get into that major championship, and she beat them all that week. She'd overcome injury and doubt and thought about leaving the game. She caddied for a buddy. She'd done all these different things, and to win that major in that form, and considering how thin her resume had been and how much doubt she'd had leading up to that week, to be able to find it, Sofia Popov, in my opinion, one of the great underdog stories in this game.
It was certainly one of the great victory speeches that we've heard in recent years. It was such an emotional speech from her as she delved into this idea of just how low she'd been in the game and this desire to walk away from it, because it didn't look as though it was going to happen outside the top 300 in the world ranking, as you noted. To me, the speech that followed the fairy tale was a perfect capstone on what seemed like such an improbable story.
And the tears she had on 18 trying to hold it together to win that major championship. John Daly, very good. Sofia Popov. So in honor of Rich Strike's incredible upset, I want to know who are golf's greatest underdogs in your mind. Your tweet featured on this very show. History just known for underdog stories. So we got here. Oh, Y.E. Yang, 2009, huh? That's a pretty good one there.
Yes, I thought we'd use the image of him bench pressing the golf bag after that one.
Y.E.S. was Jim Nance's call, if I remember it correctly. This is Tar Heel Bourne saying, even though he finished second, my money is on Tom Watson at the 09.
Too soon, too soon. We still can't talk about this. It's too emotional.
I'm not over it either.
I was. Would have been the greatest victory in the history of sports.
It just would have been remarkable. I couldn't wait to write the story, and then I didn't want to write the story. All right, what else do we have? Brian saying Rich Beam, the Beamer, another one who got the better of Tiger. That's 0-2 PGA if memory serves.
And we'll probably see Rich playing again next week, I hope, in Southern Hills.
Yeah, he's got a doubling as a player and a broadcaster these days. Here's Jason, no more appropriate underdog to remember on the cusp of the U.S. Open at Brookline than Francis. We met the greatest underdog of them all. What do you think of that?